This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The stakes are high for real estate developers in the new China. On the outskirts of several newly urbanized cities, ornate high-rise luxury apartment buildings sit empty. The competition for buyers is fierce, giving rise to companies which stage elaborate events, many using foreigners to play the part of celebrities, models, or even building engineers to gin up the glamour in these real estate ghost towns. Here is a pair of handsome foreigners for rent.
In China, you can be anything without any knowledge or education.
Yeah.
if you're from the West.
And you can be a doctor, you can be an actor, you can be a...
I mean, it's...
Well, fake.
Yes,
fake,
everything is fake.
Yeah.
We just show up to give them a white face.
And that's a clip from Chinese Dreamland, a documentary in progress by film and television director David Borenstein. The film follows this booming new industry built on presenting empty apartment buildings as glamorous destinations for China's new rich. A short of the film is online at the New York Times OpDocs. And David Borenstein joins us now from Copenhagen. David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi there. Glad to be here.
So how many empty properties are we talking about in China?
Well, it's tough to make any estimates because the official statistics in China are very difficult to really get a hand on. And it's difficult to even know if the central government knows how many empty apartment buildings are out there, mainly because the local governments are so committed to not letting them know about it.
Give us a sense of like how it looks, these unbelievable buildings just rising out of what appear to be empty wasteland.
It's probably most striking in the third and fourth tier cities. I mean, basically, most new cities in China start as ghost towns. They build it, and then they intend for the people to eventually come and fill it up. So that's kind of spawned this industry that's called the city image industry in China. It's very, very important. It's a very high-risk thing to make a city in China. You're building a brand new city out of nothing, and it's very important to create the idea and the illusion among everyone that this place is inevitably going to develop into an international, thriving metropolis. So it's not a question of where to find them. Everything is a ghost town in China when it first starts, all of these new developments. You go out to, this film was took place in the Sichuan province, which is in western China, and you go around to any third or fourth tier city, and you're going to see huge rows of empty apartment buildings, huge stadiums, huge racetracks. These are all things that we've filmed in this film, and it's extremely interesting to see.
Well, you profile one company, the Exotic Flavor Talent Agency, in the film. They are one of those businesses that try and trump things up to look like an international destination. How many companies in China are doing this kind of work?
It's a huge industry. There's industry training. There's conferences. In a word, it's a very complex industry with lots of competition, lots of players, and lots of innovative ways of using foreigners.
So I'm assuming that you're talking about Yana, right?
Right.
Okay, so there's a scene in the op doc where Yana is talking with what I'm assuming is a colleague about, you know, how you stage these kind of events.
Yeah.
What does she tell him about specifically who are the most juicy, attractive demographic for this kind of thing?
Well, white people. White people fetch the highest prices, whereas darker-skinned performers tend to fetch lower prices.
The translation that I read in the film is, you know, it's true that white people are expensive, but it makes the place feel classier. And if you can't squeeze out the funds but still want to project an international atmosphere, I suggest using black people. They are very open and quite cheap. I mean, is this happening?
No, that happens all the time. But I think what's most interesting is when you press Yana and you talk to them and you say, listen, why are you ranking people like that? That's something that's absolutely alien to my ears. When I ask her this question in the feature-length film, her response is this. Her response is, aren't white and black people not equal in America?
Whoa, snap. That's a pretty blunt appraisal.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think that speaking with Yana really, and speaking with a lot of people in China about race in general, it just seems that it exposed my own ideas as an American. We go around saying that everyone is equal, and we go around saying that everyone is ensured political rights as being equal. But if we don't act like it, then a bunch of Chinese agents are going to point that out and package these American-style hierarchies into this consumable package.
Well, how do they find and prep these foreigners who play the part of exotic Westerners?
Well, there's many different ways. The way that seems to be the most common is they just go out and find them. They go to bars, they go to study abroad students and places where they hang out and where they study. They talk to them, they say, do you have any talent? Oh, I have no talent. Oh, well, it's okay. What's most important in these gigs is what they look like. Mm-hmm. When they're selling them to these real estate developers, they give them the pictures. And let's say a real estate developer wants a country band. This is something that actually, before I started filming, I did with a friend who was a country singer in the United States. He was actually a very talented country singer. He was visiting China for a week, and one of these agents came up to us and asked, well, we're looking for a country singer for this country-themed event that this real estate developer is putting on. And I said, wow, actually, I have this friend right now who is a country singer. He has some critical acclaim in America, and we had the perfect guy for you. And so we said, great. But when we got there, everything changed. The real estate developer had decided that in his mind, and remember, we're in rural China where this all-powerful leader is putting on this event according to whatever his wild imagination says is a famous American country band. And in his imagination, a famous American country band had a beautiful woman as a singer. So my friend wasn't allowed to sing. And instead, they got some beautiful woman who didn't know how to sing. And she wasn't from America. She was from Spain and singing in heavily accented English. And moreover, he had this idea that famous country bands in America, well, I don't know how this happened, but in the middle of the set, he insisted that four or five Africans dressed in loincloths come out and play drums over it. Oh, and they didn't even plug in the guitar of my friend, who is the real country singer. So imagine this. We were on a stage in front of thousands of people. There's a real country singer wearing a cowboy hat who's not plugged in. He's just playing and no one can hear him. There's a Spanish woman that's singing, I think it's Sweet Home Alabama, over a backing track. And there's four or five African drummers that are just singing and dancing on the stage over this backing track. It was one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen in my life.
Oh my goodness. I mean, but there is a scene, right, where these men are walking down a runway in their underwear. Now, they're being introduced as some of America's top models. The crowd is cheering, taking photographs. Sort of like you're describing, this is what everybody's image, or this is what an individual's image is of what fame looks like, based on some perception of the American model. I mean, do people believe this?
It's difficult to say. A lot of the places that we go to, I mean, they're all real estate events, and it seems that they can be quite contentious. We've been to areas where the local peasant population, many of whom we later found out were forcibly removed from their land for very little compensation. We've been to events where they seem to be the very skeptical ones, where they're the ones that are voicing, sometimes very vigorously voicing their opposition to what's going on. Whereas the rich speculators who are coming in just for the afternoon from the cities, they seem to be the naive ones. I would say that this whole film has been an exercise in seeing what a boom, an economic boom, to see what speculative fever can do to someone. Mm. Because some of these events are so clearly fake. We filmed a fake Olympics once. We filmed, there was an Olympic opening ceremony and a huge sporting event that took place. And it was just so clear that no one was a professional athlete, but no one said anything. And to me, it just seems to be people are believing what they want to believe.
What is the success rate for these types of events? I mean, how many sales are made after the party is over?
I would say it's difficult to say. And it also depends on what time we were filming. We were filming over several years. And so we started filming at the peak of this boom back in 2010, 2009, 2011. And at this time, we would film these events. And after the event, Yana told us that the real estate developers told her that they would sell hundreds of homes all in one time.
Well, wow, did the buyers then expect to be living amongst these glamorous foreigners?
It's difficult. Sometimes a lot of things are unsaid. So you have the foreigners there, and sometimes the developers let the audience just make assumptions without saying anything. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of protest against false advertising in real estate recently in China. Since last spring, prices have been falling in most areas of China, and people have been becoming quite upset because the houses that they were told were in these booming international cities ended up being kind of in ghost towns. So we were at a real estate expo, and a huge crowd of disgruntled home buyers came and just destroyed the entire display.
Wow.
And they told us this place was going to be a thriving international city. They told us this place was going to be have great schools, have lots of work. They said that foreign companies are investing in this new town, and the foreigners are all going to be living there. So that seems to have been a lie.
David Bornstein, what an eye-opening film. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Bornstein, he's a film and television director. He's based in Copenhagen. And there is a short version of his forthcoming feature documentary, Chinese Dreamland. It's in OpDocs. That's the New York Times Forum for Opinionated Documentary Shorts. You'll find a link to look at it at wordofmouthradio.org. The Red Sox and Yankees, Ali Frazier, the Celtics, and the Lakers are among America's classic sports rivalries. But according to Ken Shulman, they have nothing on the world's biggest arch rivals, the India and Pakistan cricket teams. Ken Shulman is a journalist and founder and host of Away Games. It's a new television series and educational platform that looks at lives, conflicts, and cultures through the lens of sport. And Ken Shulman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. For this episode, you did travel to Delhi to document a match that's between India and Pakistan. First, a little bit about the significance of this match.
We have to remember that India and Pakistan are two nuclear powers that have fought four major wars and several minor skirmishes. We also have to remember that they were once the same country before 1947, before the British departed. There's history, there's rivalry, there's ethnic tension, and of course there's the religious tension between Hindus and Muslims.
This was the first match they'd played, what, in how long?
Bilateral cricket between the two countries was suspended after the Mumbai terror attacks in 2008, when Indian intelligence discovered that the Pakistani military had involvement in the terror attacks in Mumbai. They closed down trade, they closed down visa regimes, and of course, in something that only the truly cricket mad can understand, they closed down bilateral cricket. When the countries want to start making nice again, and this happens periodically, one of the first things they do is they send their team for a cricket tour.
So it's like diplomacy.
It is called cricket diplomacy. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
So what was the scene like, the atmosphere, before this epic match?
This was a series. There were five matches across India. We filmed in Delhi. I attended matches elsewhere. I attended matches in Chennai, which used to be Madras, and I also attended matches in Kolkata. Most of the scenes were of great fraternity. You have to remember that in places like Punjab and places like Bengal, those regions were split. So you have Punjabi Pakistanis and you have Punjabi Indians who have more in common with each other than they do with people from other regions in their own country. So when they get together, you can't tell the Hindus from the Muslims. They look the same. They speak the same language. They eat the same food. They all watch the same movies. The scenes that I saw were scenes of, it was like a love fest.
Maybe there was fraternity on the scene, but getting there was really difficult. There was one Pakistani family you spoke to. It must have taken them a day to get there. Why?
Their journey from Lahore to Delhi, which if you could drive it, should take 4 hours, took over 24 hours. They had 10 hours at the border, then another 10 hours in Indian customs. The regimes are so tense. The relationships between the two countries are so tense that it's tough for Pakistanis to get into India. And when they go there, they have to stay in circumscribed zones. This particular family that we interviewed couldn't leave Delhi to see the Taj Mahal, and they were very distressed about that.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge undertaking for them to come. So what else is it? I mean, this is just love for cricket? What's at stake here?
Many Pakistanis are extremely curious about India. cricket series are one of the few opportunities they have to go. There's a limited number of visas available, but they will rush up, they will line up to get them. And once they do, they'll go to extraordinary lengths to get in. A little bit of history here. 1947, the British withdrew from India, and they partitioned it into a Muslim country called Pakistan and into a pluralistic country with a Hindu majority called India. And there were about 30 million people who migrated in those next 2 months. It was bloody. It was brutal. Over a million people died. And people are still feeling repercussions to that to this day. That's one of the reasons that the countries are still fighting.
Well, actually, what you found is that it's not just a Pakistani-Indian divide, but it's also a Hindu-Muslim divide. Is that something that people were open with you about?
I spoke with many Indian Muslims. One person in particular, a playwright named Samir Khan, who recalled a time in the late 1990s. He's from Pune, which is near Mumbai. He was watching an India-Pakistan match, which was played somewhere in the Gulf, I believe. No, it was played in Australia. And India won. He, as an Indian, went out to celebrate. And he got mugged by a group of Hindu nationalists who saw that he was Muslim and assumed that he was Pakistani. I spoke with another person who tried to go to a match in Delhi Stadium. And a policeman said to him, "What are you doing here? There's no Pakistani team. This is an Indian. He just happens to be a Muslim."
And in a similarly perilous state of fandom, this is a Fawzia Khan. She's your co-producer and someone who's accompanying you on this journey, remembering being in Pakistan, the sole fan for the Indian team.
The second Pakistani wicket, I got up and I cheered really loudly. The entire stand turned to look at me and there was a hush. And then I just sat down and two girls turned around and said, "Are you from India? Are you an Indian?" And I said, "Yes." And I was really scared at that point of time. And they smiled and they said, "Can you give us some Bollywood gossip? Are Amitabh Bachchan and Rekha really seeing each other?" And then we started talking, and then cokes and chips were passed around, and there was a lot of banter, there was a lot of camaraderie between us.
There are two venues where Indians and Pakistanis can really bond. One is cricket, and the other is Bollywood. And here we have both. Mm-hmm. We have Fawzia Khan, who was born in Lucknow, which is a Muslim town in northern India. In the 90s, she went to visit cousins in Lahore that she had never met before. And she wanted to go to the stadium with them for the match. There was an India-Pakistan match at the time. And she wanted to make banners. And they said, "No, we'll disown you. We'll restrain you." But she ended up going. And when she says she cheered for Pakistani wicket, a wicket is when a team makes an out. It's mm-hmm. a big deal. And she just reflexively stood up and cheered. And she was quite afraid. But all the people really wanted to know was the Bollywood gossip. And she had a great experience.
Well, you talk about the diplomatic history, but how about the history of cricket in India? I mean, this was a colonials game. Were people who were Indians even allowed to play?
In the origin, when the British first arrived, it was restricted just to the British. Strangely enough, the first group that started to play cricket that was not white Anglo were the Parsis. The Parsis are a Persian group that migrated to the area around Goa in about 900. After that, in Mumbai, various communal teams, the Hindus, the Muslims, the Parsis, and the Europeans, used to play in a tournament called the Quadrangular. It was a big deal. Cricket for Indians was one way that they could prove that they were just as good as their colonial masters. But there's another upward mobility story here. In the early 20th century, there was a man named Palwankar Ballu. Ballu was a Dalit, otherwise known as an untouchable. He found a job in Pune, a town near Mumbai, tending a cricket pitch. And it turned out he was a really good bowler, a pitcher. And the Europeans used to give him an extra nickel to pitch them batting practice. This man was Hindu, but he was untouchable. When the Hindu team had to play the Muslim team in Mumbai, the Hindus did not want him because he was an untouchable. The Europeans intervened. They got him on the team, and he ended up becoming one of the greatest bowlers in Indian history. And he is the Jackie Robinson of India.
I mean, we do often hear when the Olympics are happening, you know, the sports transcend all boundaries or ideologies. Is that the case with cricket in India and Pakistan?
It can be. I mean, sport is a reflection of society. Society has its positive points and it's got its bumps. And there have been India-Pakistan matches that have been suspended because the crowd's been throwing objects at the players. There have been riots. I don't think anyone's been killed at a cricket riot in India, but I'm not sure about that. However, sport, in my mind, and this is sort of the point of away games, for us, sport is a lingua franca. It is the universal language. It's the one thing that really cuts across class, nationality, gender, politics, and even language, even more than food, even more than literature even more than film, because everyone does it in the same way. The guy who plays soccer at Phillips Exeter Academy has the exact same rules that the guy who's playing in a favela in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Mm-hmm. They're playing the same match, and they have the same expectations. You and I who watch the match, if I watch it in Australia and you watch it in Boston, we're still seeing the same match. I don't think that's true about any other human pursuit.
How about the sport of cricket in particular, though? I mean, is there something about it that lends itself to this rival narrative?
I think in this particular case between India and Pakistan, the lingering hostility, the lingering shame of colonialism, the idea that even the original sin of partition is due to having been colonized, comes out of the same spirit that drives the people to play cricket. They play cricket because they want to prove that they were good Englishmen and that they're better than Englishmen. They took the colonial sport and they made it their own, and they're now some of the best in the world. Very interesting point. We had cricket, in the United States too. We also had the British in the United States, but our period of colonialism was a lot shorter and a lot less oppressive. And because of that, we were probably freer to take that game. We didn't have anything to prove that we were as good as the British on the sporting field. So we took their cricket, we then made it into a game called rounders, and we then made it into a game called baseball. We were free to do that. The Indians didn't have that freedom. They had the British in their house for 200-300 years. And as I said, the occupation was much more oppressive. The colonial regime was much more onerous there. They had something to prove, and they stuck with cricket.
You did watch this match between India and Pakistan in a house divided, a marriage between an Indian man and a Pakistani woman. Let's take just a little quick listen of that game.
He's from Delhi. She's from Lahore in Pakistan. On most days, it's not a problem. But today's not most days.
The pitch has bowlers.
Do you think this marriage can survive with cricket?
No.
That is a long pause.
Right.
Ken Schulman there from Away Games speaking to Yeezy. From Away Games, a new series that he's launching. What was going on there?
We were very fortunate to find this family. There's not that many. They're actually distant cousins. She's from Lahore. He's from Delhi. The husband and their two children are Indian citizens. She's a Pakistani national. And on most days, they get along fine. When India plays Pakistan, it's sort of like someone from Brooklyn marrying someone from Brookline. And it's all in good fun, and they eat the same food, but they stand on opposite sides of the room, and they root for different teams.
Yeah, and the kids are rooting for India. I think it kind of stings her a little bit.
It does, but she takes it in good spirit. And towards the end of the episode, she sort of gives her marriage a second thought. Maybe it will work out, even despite the cricket rivalry.
It is the opinion of some of the ladies that you speak to that the Pakistani team is better looking than the Indian team. Is one team actually better than the other in this rivalry?
It depends. Pakistan has a slight edge in these teams have been meeting since, I think they first met bilaterally in 1952. Partition happened in 1947. There were a few problems to work out before they could even meet on the cricket field. Pakistan, I believe, has a slight edge overall. But like with any sports team, there are cycles. And the Indian team will have a cycle where they're very strong. The Pakistani team will have a cycle where they're very strong. But my opinion, again, looking at the photos, the Pakistani men are better looking.
Well, Ken Schulman, we finally settled that. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm glad we got that out into the open.
Ken Schulman's a journalist and founder and host of the television series Away Games. You'll find a link to watch the first episode, The World's Greatest Rivalry, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Where does it come from, the material of the beautiful? And how aligned or skewed toward discord, how reasoned with ardor and risk, how little or much design or dumbfound, how can we know? Grave, heavenly, like the illumined face of a god rubbed from stone, these breaths so wholly numbered and numinous.
That's New Hampshire poet laureate Alice Fogle reading from Aria. It's the first and last poem from Interval, poems based on Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations, which we're listening to right now.
when I listen to music, I feel like it is an embodiment of spirit. And even though it's a mathematical structure on the page of intervals and durations, we react to it, respond to it in almost a spiritual or certainly an emotional way. And I think that is what life is about, too. We have this body, a structure, but we feel we are more than that. That's really behind where this whole book came from.
Bach's work was first published in 1741 and consists of an aria and 30 variations made up of 32 measures each, a sampler of Western dance music enjoyed during his time. Vogel borrows that structure and works within those constraints to invent 30 poems of 32 lines each. The voice and form of each one changes, inspired by Bach's variations in mood and key and tempo.
Bach's music is in voices. That's what fugues and canons are. They're layers of voices. So that said to me, let's make each of these poems be in a different voice, of a different character, in a kind of a threshold state of life, which would somehow evoke the sense of embodiment of spirit. So I began to channel or imagine different characters.
Here is variation number 7, Girl.
Just because your mother wouldn't talk about it and her mother slapped her face, and who knows what all the mothers did before that, cover them with earth and wine, chant hymns to the goddess. If I ever have a daughter, here's all I'm going to do. Say, that's nice, honey, or you go, girl, or whatever is hip when she's 13, and let her pierce anything she wants.
Alice Vogel studied classical music, and she also worked in the theater as a costume designer. I asked her how she approached that somewhat theatrical transformation into the voice of another.
I definitely felt that I was writing fiction, which was very new for me. I never was a narrative poet. I never talked very much about myself. So being able to pretend that I was these other people was really fun and different for me.
I found myself reading these poems looking for, where's Alice Vogel in here?
Oh, I've snuck myself in there, here and there.
Vogel's poems play with layers of identity and the shadow selves. In variation 18, Baker, Bach's piece, is a canon, a piece of music using two or more instruments or voices starting at different times, like a round. But imagine, like in this piece, instead of waiting for the complete row, row, row your boat verse before jumping in, the second voice launches in after row.
In variation 18, there's only one beat of music between the leader voice and the follower voice. So I felt that the baker was someone who is very close to the work that he does in making and breaking bread every morning. So I brought the two things together. And it does feel like a spiritual kind of work to bake bread, to make bread and incorporate air into this solid and then to eat it. Variation 18, Baker. Always, already, the wheat in the field, hunger, rain, the stalks in the bleeding hand, grain in the mill, chaff on the ground. Grain ground until all airs banished, all spaces fill with the lighter, heavier powder of flour.
In the baker's hands at the break of day, wheat becomes flour and combines with yeast and is molded into loaves and baked and broken, with steam rising into the air before being eaten, transformed like musical notes on the page and words that become poems.
I do think that poetry also is an experience of life that is put into language, which is more concrete. So poetry also evokes more than it actually says.
Do you recommend that people read these poems with the music?
Oh, I think everybody should listen to the music. I should say you don't have to know the Bach or listen to the Bach to read the poems. It's a book of poems, which is challenging enough in itself. So people who are not familiar with the Bach should not feel that they wouldn't be able to enter into the poems at all. They helped me write the poems, and I actually wonder if I might offend some people by, if you really love the Bach and you read the poems and you think, why is that poem that? I would definitely want to give you permission to just separate them if you wanted to.
What do you think Bach would think?
I think Bach would get a kick out of it. He was stealing all the time. He was going out to the bars and stealing lines from a song that somebody was humming over their beer, and also popular music, and he was doing what we would now call sampling and incorporating those things into his own work. So I think that kind of idea of stealing or borrowing was really interesting to him, and so he would probably get a kick out of somebody else doing it.
New Hampshire Poet Laureate Alice Fogel. Her new book of poems based on Bach's Goldberg Variations is called Interval. For more on readings and to hear Alice Fogel read the complete Variation 18 poem Baker, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. For this segment, we use the solo piano recordings of the Goldberg Variations by Murray Pariah. That gorgeous arrangement for strings features Dmitri Sitkovetsky on violin. And in the spirit of Bach, this is a remix conceived by DJ Spooky and performed by the Telos Ensemble at the Luxembourg Philharmonic. The Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt is an incredible structure. Of course, it was built thousands of years ago before steel girders or cranes or trucks were on the scene. Although a big draw for spiritual seekers, the oldest and largest of the pyramids was not made by mystics, but was the deliberate product of very talented engineers. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible explores how practicality played a role in creating one of history's most ambitious buildings.
Steve Burrows is a principal at an engineering consulting company called Arup.
I'm Steve Burrows, CBE, and I'm a professional engineer.
And when he saw the Great Pyramid in Egypt for the first time, he reacted pretty much the way I imagine most people react.
When you actually go and see something that's somewhere in the region of 40 stories high, that was built 4,000 years ago, you know, you just have this incredible wow moment.
But then that structural engineer brain kicks in.
Every time you look at something, you think, first of all, how did they do that? Then I start thinking, how would I do that?
And in a recent article in Design Intelligence, he took those questions head on, as if a client gave him a brief to build something like the Great Pyramid today.
We get these incredible challenges where you're doing something that's never been done before. So one of the incredible facts for me was that the Great Pyramid stood as the tallest building in the world for centuries.
And as someone who, in the present day, is hired to engineer seemingly impossible structures, Steve Burrows thinks that the engineers of 2600 BC really knew what was possible and made most of the major decisions as a present-day engineer would.
So some of the things they knew were that if they built on the Giza Plateau, they could put stones that to a certain pressure and the ground didn't collapse beneath it.
You can look at other pyramids and see the previous mistakes that were made.
And they got to know what the ground capacity was. And I think that determined the size of the Great Pyramid.
Because if you're going to build the tallest building in the world, how tall do you want it to be?
Do you want it to be a mile? Or just a bit taller than the last tallest building?
You've got to make a decision.
And I think the decision was made for them by the quality of the ground that they were building on.
So that was number one.
Secondly, they had to build it in the Pharaoh's lifetime. And I'm pretty sure that somebody, you know, a contractor said, you know, with the best will in the world, we can only lay this number of stones a day, and I can only assemble this many men.
And assembling men seems to be the right wording here, because, and I totally missed this historical revision, but the consensus now is that it was a rather privileged, well-treated class of Egyptians that built the pyramids, not slaves. That blew my mind. Cecil B. DeMille is going to be pissed.
20,000 men can only lay this many stones a day, And the pharaoh typically lives 35 years. So, you know, that many men times that many stones times 35 years means it's going to be this high.
So the ground can only hold so much mass without buckling. The workers can only build so much in a pharaoh's lifetime. And finally, the material had to be delivered to the site in time to build the thing.
And I would think, depending where the quarry was relative to the actual site, which was chosen for its known ground bearing capacity and also height and visibility above Cairo, they also figured out that they could only get so many stones there. They only had so much material of the quality at the quarry.
So Steve Burrows thinks that these practical engineering considerations determine the size of the pyramid, its height, the number of stones, and ultimately what we all marvel at thousands of years later.
It wasn't so much mystique as just practical necessity.
Another practical consideration that led to the pyramid's longevity is material chemistry. There are other ancient buildings that have not held up as well as the pyramid.
The buildings I saw had lasted thousands of years, and they hadn't all performed perfectly well. So it was pretty clear to me that the Egyptians had a pretty good understanding of the material they were working with, but it wasn't 100% perfect. For example, the first large mud brick structures that I looked at had massive vertical cracks in them. And it was very clear to me that they were thermal cracks. What had happened is that they were used to building walls, but when a wall turns a corner, that point becomes very stiff. And because the temperatures vary hugely between day and night, these materials, these walls, expand and contract. And when it contracts, masonry will always break next to the stiff point. So every time there was a corner, I found a huge vertical crack. So they clearly didn't understand the thermal performance of mud bricks.
And that problem is exacerbated by the fact that they laid these mud bricks on a mortar bed. So they effectively have two materials for building.
So they'd used mud brick and mortar. And by putting these different materials together, they thermally move at different amounts and they had cracked.
So somebody must have said, well, if we'd only use one material, laid the bricks dry, would they have performed better? And the answer is yes.
And the pyramids are exactly that. So there is only one material that's used. That means that the pyramids, you know, they get very hot in the day and very cold at night.
But the material throughout the pyramid is consistent.
And so it didn't crack. Because they move together, they effectively breathe. And because they breathe to account for the changes in temperature, they're able to last a long time without cracking and breaking up.
So this prompted Burrows to think about modern buildings, where we put so many materials together all the time.
Steel and glass and aluminium and concrete and cementitious materials and plasterboard. And I started walking around modern buildings and looking at where all the cracks were. And every crack is at the joint between different materials. And I started to think, maybe we could think about this a little bit more. And if we did, we could actually make buildings last longer just by thinking harder about those joints, which presently we solve by putting, you know, gooey material in the joint to try and take up that thermal movement. But if we just detail them better in the first place, they would last longer. And I think, you know, the longer buildings last, the more sustainable they are. So the longer their life and the less materials we use in the long run.
Longevity is probably the most basic route to sustainability, and the pyramids are the poster children for longevity.
You know, there's an old Arab saying, man fears time, but time fears the pyramids.
In addition to chemistry, adhering to basic principles of physics keeps your building around for millennia with little or no maintenance. A pyramid is a nice, stable shape.
And I think they will have learned that.
But it isn't as simple as the way I was thinking about it.
If they had a bucket of sand and they poured it on the floor, then it actually naturally makes a pyramid shape. So intuitively, they know that that is a stable thing to do. But actually, one of the interesting things is that the gradient of the sides of the pyramid is not determined like sand by its natural angle of repose. You can actually make it whatever you want to make it. But you can see from the prior pyramids, from the step pyramid and the bent pyramid, the pyramids that preceded the Great Pyramid, that they were sort of going a little bit steeper, but they never really got above 50 degrees. Because I think somebody felt that there's a sort of a maximum angle about which we should never exceed.
So again, empirically derived knowledge sets the agenda.
If you put these things together, how much stone you can get, the bearing pressure that you can put on the ground and the angle, you know, it determines the height of the building. And I'm pretty sure the simple mathematics and the work between the architect, engineer, and contractor gave a practical limit to what could be built.
This exercise in using engineering principles to augment the archaeological data may give us some insight into why the Great Pyramid is both the oldest and the largest pyramid of Giza. Because people probably thought it was the limit of everything. It's the biggest bearing capacity, it's as steep as they could go, and it's as many stones as can be laid in a lifetime. You can't do any bigger than that.
You know, it's the speed of light, if you like, for building pyramids.
I know it's no revelation that the pyramids are well designed, I'm not an idiot, but learning about these practical considerations from Steve Brose just made me appreciate their majesty in a new way. These structures are not otherworldly. You don't need to come up with crazy theories to explain them. They are the product of smart architects and designers and engineers and skilled workers who applied knowledge that was gained over time and passed down over generations. And through that perfectly understandable and repeatable process, they discovered their limit. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't ever want to see the tallest building we could possibly build, but I might like to see the one designed with enough durability and flexibility to last for 4,000 years.
And that was Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible. I've never been the type to change the oil in my own car. I prefer to leave that to the professionals. But it is comforting to know that if I chose to learn how, I could pop the hood and do it myself. And yet, the increasingly computerized nature of automobiles and a far-reaching 1998 copyright law threaten the ability of home mechanics and tinkerers to make DIY repairs to their very own vehicles. Kyle Weens is founder of iFixit. That's an online community that creates and shares free repair guides. He's also a contributor to Wired magazine, where he recently wrote a scathing op-ed entitled, "We Can't Let John Deere Destroy the Very Idea of Ownership." He's here to tell us more. Kyle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So there are two parts to your opinion piece. The first, pretty easy to grasp, that cars are more computerized, so they're just harder to tinker with. The other problem, however, is that owners are not allowed to tinker with certain parts of the car. Now, how can that be?
Well, we are adding electronics into everything. And there is a different set of laws that regulate electronics than regulate other types of property because electronics have software in them. And so you have copyright law that governs what you can do with digital works, like saying that you can't copy a movie or you can't copy an MP3 file. Manufacturers are using the same laws that restrict copying of digital products to limit what we can do with our physical real products like cars.
And when you talk about copyright laws, one specific Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998 kind of was set up to govern this line between software and hardware. What does that DMCA, as they call it, cover?
Right. So this is an update. This is U.S. copyright law. And what there's a specific piece of it that says that in addition to it being illegal to copy things that you don't own, it is also illegal to break locks that protect access to the content. So it's like a car manufacturer saying, hey, if you open the hood of your car, you void the warranty. Okay, fine. You can do that if you want. But they're also saying we're going to pass a law to make it illegal for you to open the hood. That's really what the problem is that's impacting tinkers, mechanics, even people that want to fix their iPhones.
Well, what specifically then does it restrict? What can't you do?
What you can't do is modify the software that's on these devices. So if you have a car and you want to modify the engine tuning, they're saying that it's a violation of copyright law to go in and change a parameter in your engine.
So this is being challenged right now, and the U.S. Copyright Office is deciding in July which high-tech devices we can modify or hack. Now, we know that John Deere and General Motors both submitted comments to the Copyright Office for this, but you put John Deere squarely in the crosshairs. Why that company in particular?
I have a lot of friends that are farmers. I live in a farming community in San Luis Obispo, California, and there's a lot of people here that are used to being self-reliant. They've been buying tractors, they've been working on farms their entire lives. Being a farmer sort of is the definition of self-reliant. Oftentimes you're miles away from civilization. You have to be able to figure things out on your own. And a friend of mine, a farmer named Dave, came to me and said, hey, I have a tractor and there's a sensor that's malfunctioning. And when the sensor malfunctions, the tractor won't go. And so I call John Deere and they say, well, we can have a technician out with a new part in 2 days. And he says, no, you don't understand. That's not good enough. I have to have the tractor out in the field during those 2 days. And so he wants me to help him bypass this sensor. Well, I can't do that without modifying the software on the computer. So this is a very common problem that's impacting more and more farmers. As electronics move into farm equipment, the same issue that prevents you from unlocking your cell phone is also preventing farmers from maintaining their own equipment. This is all about control. This is about who has the right to do what with the things that we own. Is it us, the people that own it, or is it the people who made it and sold it to us? And the manufacturers are trying to extend their sphere of control to everything that you ever do with the thing that they made, even though you paid them good money for it. They're saying, no, you only bought the physical product. You didn't buy the license to be able to continue to operate it.
Okay. So what are some of the modifications you think people should be able to make to their vehicles?
Well, there's a lot of common sense things that you might want to be able to do. You might not realize this, but farmers are constantly tinkering and creating new farm implements. If you buy a John Deere tractor, it's kind of like having a blender or a mixer in your house. If you have a KitchenAid, there's all kinds of attachments you can hook onto the KitchenAid. It's the same thing with a tractor. Your tractor is horsepower, and then you attach various things to it to do what you're going to do in the field. Well, sometimes they'll want to add a new sensor onto their farming implement and hook it up to the tractor to get power. Some repairs you need to be able to go in and modify engine timings. You might need to turn off a fan or something on the engine so that you can get in there and work on it. So normal repairs, you're in there, you're doing all kinds of things. And this idea that the people who made it in the first place know exactly how it's going to be used for its entire life is just preposterous.
I'm speaking with Kyle Weens. He's founder of the free online repair guide iFixit, about the very idea of what it means to own your own car. He says car companies like General Motors and industrial equipment makers like John Deere are making it hard or impossible for home mechanics to access software integrated into their vehicles. He argues that if you can buy it, you should have the right to repair or change it. But companies like John Deere and General Motors, they're liable if something goes wrong with their equipment, right? I mean, what do you say to companies concerned that tinkering could jeopardize safety or even emission systems built to comply with federal standards?
Yes, this is something that the manufacturers bring up repeatedly. They say, hey, you know, we've got liability for the products we put out there. And we say, well, people have been fixing cars for decades, and it hasn't been a problem. I'm a software guy. I'm a software engineer by trade, and I can tell you there's no difference when it comes to starting to tinker with computers. They might seem complicated and harder, but we have the same issues dealing with making sure that we do repairs safely on electronics that we have had making sure that you repair your brakes safely is something that independent mechanics, that tinkers in their garages have been able to do for decades, and there's no reason we can't continue to do that.
Thinking that if consumers have to bring their cars to authorized dealers for repairs or have them come out into the field in the case of the tractor, what does that do to this American tradition of grease monkeys, the third-party mechanics? Is it in danger of collapsing because of these copyright laws and the sheer complexity of new vehicles?
I think it's a concern anytime you tell the next generation, you tell children, no, you're not allowed to take things apart. Because if you think about it, who are the engineers who design the things that we have now? Engineers get into it because they're excited. They want to understand. They want to learn how things work. Children are naturally curious. I was at a maker fair over the weekend, and we showed kids a cell phone. And we said, hey, do you want to take a cell phone apart? And their eyes just lit up. They got really excited because they've never seen the inside of a cell phone. So in order to make sure that we get people excited about science and engineering and technology, we have to maintain this tinkering spirit, or America is going to lose ground to other countries that are more willing to teach people at a young age how things work and how to make them.
So this review is coming up in July. What can consumers do now?
The Copyright Office is doing a short-term review. Every 3 years they review and they grant limited exceptions. But what we really need to do is fix things. So Representative Lofgren from California has introduced the Unlocking Devices Act, which would solve this problem permanently. That's really what we need. There are also a number of states, Minnesota and New York, have introduced fair repair laws, trying to even the playing field between consumers and manufacturers.
Kyle Weens, founder of iFixit. It's an online community that creates and offers repair manuals. Kyle, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kyle's essay and articles have appeared in several publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Wired, where we found his article about John Deere and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McCullough.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.